is. It's basketball. It's not a f***ing soft sport.
I love it, Gabe. I love it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. I'm recording this on the night of Thursday, the 12th of March, at about, well, quite late, about 10 o'clock. Interesting week, but before we get into that, if you're a first-time listener, be sure to subscribe to the show so you get the new ones all the time, and rate and review if you feel the inclination. Next week, I'm after game two, which will certainly frame up this series. I'm going to hopefully get another guest on, maybe Body. We shall see. Let's start things off. I want to do a couple of things on this podcast. I want to look at Casper Ware, the substitution patterns of Will Weaver and Trevor Gleeson. I want to talk about game two itself and what holds for the future in game two. And then I want to talk about Nick Kay, Josh Giddey, and of course the coronavirus, which is sweeping over the basketball across the planet. But let's start with Casper Ware. My question to you guys is, Casper Ware did not play well in game one, hasn't really got off in these finals really, had one decent game against Melbourne, hasn't really got off. And I wanted to kind of see, well, what's the difference? You know, Casper Ware, 30 years old, last year was runner-up MVP, I believe, tied with Cotton, I'm not too sure, but certainly in that conversation. You know, where's the scoring at? So I thought, have things changed from moving to Melbourne to Sydney? So I thought, let's have a look at it. So this season, Casper Ware is averaging 30.2 minutes per game, and last year, 34.2. So he's dropped down 4 minutes. And you, following along, you tell me, or in your mind, think, would this make a difference and somehow explain or rationalize why he's struggling? So 4 minutes less this season from last. Points per game, though, 18.4 this season, 18.9 last year, even though he played more minutes. Field goal percentage, 37% in NBL 20 and 39.9% last season. So he has dropped down about, let's say, 3%. And making and taking a similar number, to be fair. Making 6.5 baskets last year of 16 attempts. This year, 6 of 16. So, you know, half a basket less a game. But the same amount of attempts, which is peculiar. I thought maybe he's struggling because he's not going to the line as much. Well, that's not true either. This year, he's averaging 5 free throw attempts. And last year, at 3.7. So, quite a drop there. Quite an increase from last year on about 1.5 free throws thereabouts. 3-point percentage. Now, this is where the big drop-off is. 29% this season, 35% in NBL 19. Turnovers, 2.2 this year, 2.6 last year, so pretty similar. Assists, down a little bit, down half of an assist. 3.8 this season, 4.3 last season. I probably should have taken into account 3-point attempts. I mean, you look there, the shots, the threes just aren't going down. And why is that? Well, let's have a think. Is it the fatigue from the defensive strategy? Is he getting hung up on those screens and having to do a lot of that coverage by himself with the drops? Is he getting fatigued throughout the game? Not so sure. Casper's a pretty impressive physical character. I'm not sure. Is there an injury we're not aware of? Doubtful. And this is what I think it may be it. Is it that the unique substitution patterns of the Kings this season has thrown him off his long-range shooting ability? And this is a pattern that has perhaps flown in the face of the hot hand theory by Joshua B. Miller and others. This was a paper I read on SSRN, which is a sort of hipster intellectual types jump on there and write papers about all kinds of stuff. And there's a lot on this sort of NBA draft and age restriction, but this one was particularly about a mathematical theory about whether you're more likely to hit shots after hitting some or not. Because obviously, if you're standing taking a shot, whether you've hit 10 in the past or none, it's still the same degree of difficulty on the shot you're shooting right at that point. Well, this article flies in the face of that. It says, actually, once you've hit a couple, your chances improve. Now, that's a modern, that's not an outrageous thought, the hot hand theory. Oh, he's got a hot hand, let's test it. But it is interesting to see it backed up mathematically. And if you want to read that, go to SSRN and type in Joshua B. Miller. And he is a lecturer or a professor at Melbourne University. And it's a good read. Some 50 pages, so I hope you like maths. But anyway, Weaver's substitution pattern versus Trevor Gleeson's. Now, I've put this out on Twitter and a couple of people have picked it up. Be interesting to see if it makes its way into the telecasting game too. But Gleeson, 22 subs, and in the quarter-by-quarter breakdown went 5, 6, 8, and 3 in the fourth quarter. His first sub was at the 4 minute and 29 second mark. 4 minute and 29 second mark of the first quarter. He took out Miles Plumlee and Mitch Norton and put in Jesse Wagstaff and Damian Martin. What you would call the two perhaps weaker players of his starting five. Well, it's certainly not Cotton. It's certainly not White, and it's certainly not Kay. So pretty predictable substitution pattern from Weaver there, and brings in Wagstaff and Martin. On the flip side, so Gleason had 22 subs. Will Weaver, on the other hand, had 46 subs. So just a little bit more than double. His breakdowns went 7, 12, 11, and 16. Now, he was doing offense-defense in the fourth quarter, which justifies that 16 number. But 16 is... how many times does 3 go into 16? About six times as many substitutions in the fourth quarter as Trevor Gleason, which, even if you're doing offense-defense, is a heck of a lot. Weaver's first substitution came in the first quarter at the 7 minute and 17 second minute mark, so just over 2.5 minutes in the game. And he decided to take out sort of runner-up MVP, you could call it, Jayshon Tate, and put in Xavier Cooks. Interesting substitution pattern, and I will definitely be watching this long and hard in game two to see if this is mirrored, or if this tapers down, or perhaps even goes up from Gleason or Weaver. I thought, looking at the schedule, I think Gleason saw the huge 2 week break, and he thought, I can hammer these guys minutes wise in game one, and then we have quite a sizable break until game two. The gap between games two and three is a lot closer. So it'll be interesting to see if Gleason goes a little bit more to his bench. Not just whether Will Weaver tapers how much he puts in his bench. Just a couple of stats on Weaver versus Gleason, because I feel like this is a matchup that is really starting to play out on the floor. Will Weaver is 35, turning 36 years old. There's no Wikipedia for Will Weaver, so I haven't been able to actually find it, but I think he's 35, 36. Trevor Gleason is 51. Gleason has 17 years of head coaching experience, exclusively head coaching, assistant coaching a lot more, exclusively head coaching experience, about 17 years. Will Weaver has two, both with the Long Island Nets, and now obviously third with Sydney this year. Weaver is younger or the same age as four of the Sydney Kings, three of which are in their starting lineup. He is younger than Bogut and Kickett, and around the same age as Newley and Lish. And it really harps back to, for a win now team, I mean, you look at that starting lineup, you got Bogut, who's 35, 36, Kickett, who's older than that, 37, I think, Newley around the mid-30s. You know, there's a lot of their team. It's not their starting five, but it's certainly their top six, guys in the top six. For a win now team at that age, the hiring of Will Weaver seems to be an incredibly bold and risky choice by Kings management. But as I always say, we shall see. Looking at game two, I wanted to have a look at what Sydney have done in Perth and this season. The last time, looking back at NBL 19, the last time this team won in Perth was December 14 of 2018. It was a win by 1 point. If you remember, it was a David Ware game winner, if you remember that. I think it was even a three to win it. Big hit from him. But this season, this Sydney Kings inclination under Weaver has suffered three losses, the last of which being February 10th. They lost 95-86. That was NBL 19. They played two games there. And February 1st, 2020, they lost by 10. And December 6th, 2019, they lost 96-77 in a bit of a blowout. They've now lost game one. They've now conceded home court. To win this series, the Kings have to do what they've never done, what they haven't done so far this season, and that's win in Perth. And not many teams have done that. So my question to everyone out there is, and get to me on Twitter, at NBL Pocket Pod, if you so wish, do you hold much hope for Sydney in this series? All the sort of historical mathematical data is well not in their favor. They have conceded game one, and now they have to win it on the road, which, I mean, only one team this year, and that's the Wildcats, has won an away game in the finals. And then you look through the course of NBL 20, very few teams actually won on the road. So, tough. and especially with the schedule maybe pinched a little bit closer due to coronavirus, who knows, between games 4 and 5, I mean, it just makes that travel to Perth even more impactful. But I'll answer my own question. Do I have a huge hope for Sydney in this series? I don't hold strong hopes. I have very, very slim hopes for Sydney being able to wrestle away the home court and win this series. I just don't think Perth will relinquish the home court. They got beaten by a couple of teams this year at home, some weird ones like Adelaide and a few others. But as far as big ticket games, not so much. Sydney won, I think, 8 games away from Sydney this year, the top of which probably being Cairns, but that was round 1. And they did beat Melbourne when Melo Trimble was having those huge struggles and still in the starting lineup. So Sydney haven't shown a huge aptitude in winning games away from Sydney, but they're going to need to. Let's jump away from game 2. That game's on tomorrow night. You, most people who listen to this, you're up with the games. You know what's going on. But that's my question. My eye for you is watch those substitutions, see what happens. I want to talk about something else. It's semi-finals related because he's playing in these finals, but the heading of this is all the way to the NBA for Nick Kay. Nick Kay's played really well in game 1. His last 8 games since 9 games since Plumlee's arrived have been, you know, really blue ribbon, world-class, elite performances. So I asked the question, who is this guy's agent? Real GM does not offer up an agent for Nick Kay. I then went on to find out actually who it was, but I've forgotten. But my question out there is, why is this guy not heavily in the NBA Summer League conversation? He hasn't played in the Summer League ever. Nick Kay is, 27 or 28 years old? Power forward? Let's look at this. So, my first question is with Nick Kay is, when did hard work and methodicalness, if that's a word, become the traits of a role player exclusively? I hear people say about Nick Kay, like, oh, you know, he's a hard worker and methodicalness. I think it's a branding issue with Nick Kay. Those two things, rather than being seen as the hallmark of great players, like perhaps it once was with the likes of, say, Jordan, Kobe Bryant, Charles Barkley, you know, guys who worked really hard, it's sort of now become relegated to, oh, that's what bench players do. Our star players or good players just score a lot, and then these other guys pick up the hardworking pieces. To me, that's not really how the game works or should work. Nick Kay has world-class talent in 2 areas. And if you're going to be he's not going to be a star in the NBA. So if you're going to be a bench player or a role player in the NBA, you have to have a specific talent. That's one way to sort of feed your way in there. And he does. I think he has 2. I really do. Offensive rebounding is the number 1. And the number 2 is 3-point shooting. And when I say 3-point shooting, I also mean a little bit of decision-making from the 4. Let's go all the way back to the FIBA World Cup. At the FIBA World Cup, total, this is not minutes per 36 minutes, analytic, none of this. This is just pure data. At those FIBA World Cups games, Nick Kay grabbed more offensive rebounds than Rudy Gobert, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Nikola Jokic, Miles Turner, Al-Farouq Aminu, Nikola Vucevic, Danilo Gallinari, Aaron Baines, I think I've got Gasol written here. I'm going to assume that's Mark. And Juan Hernan Gomez. All guys big, solid big, 7-footers in the NBA. And these are guys who, again, played against teams of a similar ilk as Australia. Everyone played a Senegal-type team. Everyone played at France. Everyone played at Spain, you know. It wasn't like the schedule was particularly good for Australia. In fact, they were even deemed to be in the group of death, coming up against the likes of Lithuania and banging bodies. And Nick Kay still grabbed more offensive rebounds total, not minutes adjusted, than all those guys. And then you look at what he's done this year. He's just got a laser focus for the backboard and a timing. I think offensive rebound is just like, oh, wow, you just outworked him. No, there's actually a skill involved. There's a bodying, positional skill involved, and Nick Kay is very good at it. This season in the NBL, let's talk about the three-point shooting that I spoke about. This season in the NBL, mind you, with a three-point line that is 54 centimeters closer than the hoop than the NBA, Kay has shot 48% from 3 and is 32nd in 3-point attempts at 85 and 24th in make. So it's not like he's got a high percentage because he's not shooting many or making many. He's doing both. Last season, Kay was 24 of 55 from the outside for 44%. So in the last two seasons, because let's not just go off one season, let's get as much data as we can. In 2 years, Nick Kay has shot 65 from 143 pointers for 46%. Let's take into account the length difference between the three-point line from the NBL to the NBA is 7%. It's about 50 centimeters, which is 7%. So let's say K doesn't shoot 46%. Let's say that little bit of distance takes 7% off his three-point percentage. Now, I don't think that would, but then also you factor in maybe a little bit bigger defense, but the court is wider. So let's just say purely that line is 7% longer, so therefore that takes 7% off his shooting average of 46%. Okay, let's simple maths. Maybe not accurate, but let's just thought experiment. Let's do it. So if Kay shoots 39% from the NBA 3, he would rank alongside Gordon Hayward, who shoots 39.2% this season. Hayward has made 74 of 189. Now, maybe you say, oh, that's because Hayward makes a lot more. Well, he doesn't. 1.6 three-pointers made per game for Hayward. Kay makes 1.3 per game in a 40-minute game in the NBL. And I'm not to pick on Gordon Hayward, but I'm just showing you where Nick Kay has these two skills that when you really just punch him into a computer and don't look too deep into it, you know, it's they're both a 10 feet tall hoop, same size ball. I'm just a big believer on measuring people, products, and places on what they actually do. A good rebounder is a good rebounder because they grab rebounds, not because they have all the traits of a good rebounder and all the promise on the planet. 6'10", long arms, oh, look at the bounce, look at the way. You can hear his bounce in the first row or this sort of garbage. Nick Kay is the Chad Bradford of basketball, if you've seen that famous film Moneyball with Jonah Hill and Brad Pitt. Does Nick Kay run like a duck? Yes, he does run like a duck. But what else does he do? He rebounds and he hits threes at the four spot and is a pretty good decision maker. I meant to talk about his assist to turnover ratio, but just take my word for it. It's low. Nick Kay is 27 years old, 6'9", 234 pounds. That's according to Real GM. Here on his size and age are some of his NBA comps. Kostas Antetokounmpo, brother of Giannis. He's getting paid $1.4 million a year. Amil Jefferson for Orlando. Nice sort of G League player. It was talked about him maybe signing with the Wildcats, actually. $1.6 million a year. Dragan Bender of the Phoenix Suns is a much taller than K, but similar sort of $1.68 million a year. Kyle Anderson of the Grizzlies is probably Kay's most accurate comp. Not that I watch a huge amount of the NBA, so if you're listening and getting frustrated with me, by all means get in touch if you've got a better comp. But he gets paid $9 million a year. Miles Turner of the Pacers, now you're probably going to say, oh, whoa, 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 not the athleticism. And, you know, maybe you're right, but I mean, the way Turner played at the FINA World Cup, I think you can draw a comparison between the two. He's getting paid $18 million this year alone. And then the other one who's a similar comp, probably a bit bigger than Kay, Tristan Thompson of the Cavaliers. He's getting paid $18.5 million US, crisp, clean, cut check, cash it, count it. My question to all of you out there is, could Nick Kay give comparable production to a Tristan Thompson or a Kyle Anderson on 1/18th of the budget? Could he do it for that veterans minimum, which as I understand is around about $1 million US? I think the answer is yes. And I would like to put out the idea, and if any Red Army fans are listening and Wildcat fans, I'm going to put it out on Twitter there to, you know, let's start the conversation about Nick Kay going to the NBA Summer League. I believe Craig Moller just got an invitation from the Dallas Mavericks. Finn Delaney got an invitation last year and others. Is 27 years old, is he like Anakin Skywalker in The Phantom Menace? Is he too old to be trained at 27? For the state of the world, I would hope not. That's his prime. You're getting a player who's in prime. We talk about LaMelo Ball being, and I think Mike Schmidt said he was the most talented player in the upcoming draft. And what I hear when I hear most talented player in the draft is, if you're a team looking to draft LaMelo Ball, you're thinking, great, we're drafting the opportunity to pay him to develop into his prime over the next 6 years. And considering rookie contracts are up after four, it's an expensive project to take on. Whereas Nick Kay, in his prime, if you know he doesn't deliver in the season, well, you know it's not getting any better, or presumably. I also want to say I'm not an NBL diehard. I'm not one of these people who can't see the league for what it is. The NBA has superior skill and talent and, more than anything, athleticism. But, you know, I saw Nick Kay at that FIBA World Cup, which was a step up from the NBL, and he played really well. And I think it's only fair that guys get a chance, and I would love to see Nick Kay play at NBA Summer League, and I think a lot of scouts would like to see him play as well. And that's it. I'm just seeing Nick Kay for what he could be. Okay? Other news, Josh Giddey to the Adelaide 36ers. This really surprised me. This news came out earlier this afternoon, probably about 3 or 4 o'clock. Josh Giddey. My first question was, why would he sign in Adelaide? All the white, Grant Kelly, Joey Wright, kerfuffle, and this team doesn't have a head coach. The question is, unless this deal with him was done before all the negativity. Now, whether it was done between Joey Wright leaving or Kevin White coming out and saying what he said on social media, interesting little timeline exists here. Josh's father, Warwick, was a Melbourne Tiger and is still a big part of that program as far as I could dig up online. With Warwick Giddey's connection to the Melbourne Tigers, does it give any greater credibility to the idea that Andrew Gaze could coach this 36ers team next season? And then the Jeff Van Groningen conversation? I wouldn't have thought so, but it's a thought. Giddey, he's 6'8", point guard. I mean, the other thing that would have been appealing to him is, you know, Jerome Randall, presumably not returning to Adelaide after his ACL injury in Spain, I think. That obviously opens up a lot of minutes. Who knows what Kevin White's future is with this team? So certainly you've got starting a backup spot on shaky ground. Not a bad spot for an 18-year-old who's looking to play minutes and impress. Jeff Van Groningen, I've had him on the podcast in the past. Guy just gets things done. I like him. Olgan Ulick writes in his interview with Josh Giddey, and I encourage you to go and read it. Giddey had interest from all but one NBL club. All but one. I wonder who that was. Could it be the new Tasmanian team who didn't don't have a team, don't have a manager, don't have a coach, didn't even bother, or don't even have the capacity to reach out to Josh Giddey? Perhaps. But I wonder if he meant one of the nine that currently exist in NBL 20. So my question to everyone out there is, who do you think would be that one team? My suspicion? Be the Perth Wildcats. I don't think the Next Stars is their bag. Baby. Let's jump on to the last thing for this one. And this is, you know, before we go into the games tomorrow night. Coronavirus. The NBL must be really, really nervous. I think 5 basketball leagues have self-suspended their games. The NBA, just today. The Euro League, the Euro Cup, the Basketball Champions League, and the FIBA Europe Cup. I saw that in a tweet somewhere. I mean, that's sort of 3 of the top leagues in the world. NBA, EuroLeague, EuroCup. Certainly the top 2 leagues. And then EuroCup, I don't quite know where that place is with the Spanish ACB and blah, blah, blah. Amazing. Really interesting, especially the NBA. Game 2 is on Friday the 13th of March. I mean, talk about bad omen. Game 3 is scheduled for Sunday the 15th of March. The NBL must be crossing every part of its body that can be crossed to see that it can make it to the end of these finals without having to cancel, suspend, or even an even bigger death sentence for the NBL would be to have to play these behind closed doors with no ticket sales. That's how they make their money. I wonder if this pandemic will inspire a little urgency on the part of the NBL to end the finals, get the season over with before this virus gets any more insane. So my question to the NBL and anyone listening is, when will games 4 and 5 be scheduled for if they are needed? I mean, do they go, let's just fucking end this season, and they go Sunday, let's have a game on Tuesday night and Friday, or Wednesday and Friday, and just get it out before they have any chance to have this suspended and push it into the AFL season, just lose momentum with the thing. Really tough situation for the NBL if they can't quite get it. But then also on a court, on-court perspective is, you know, where are these games going to get scheduled and how is that going to impact the home court that either team has established, be it Perth or Sydney? You know, there's a long distance between the two teams, a shorter compressed travel schedule. Who does that benefit? Most certainly you'd say the Perth Wildcats, who are more used to it and are a little bit younger. So all these factors coming into play in these NBL Grand Finals, most of them non-basketball, or certainly non-players anyway. But my best to Casper Ware, I spoke about at the top of the program. I'm a believer in Casper Ware. I think he's a great player. I don't think he shows up in the numbers. His percentages and shooting's always been a little bit... it's not the strength of his game. But I want to see him attack the basket real strong this game. He holstered the three-point shot. Leave that to Sean Bruce. Kick it. Lish, others. Focus on him getting to the basket and getting to the foul line and getting 2 feet in the paint and making passes. I think that's his way forward. It's just a simple matter of you're not making threes, don't take them. And I worry if there's that analytics thing where you just can't take enough threes, just keep shooting threes. All right, okay, you miss a lot, who cares? If you make one, it's worth two twos and all that sort of stuff. For a pacing of the game in these finals, I just want to see him attack the basket and set up his teammates, in particular, Andrew Bogut. Ladies and gentlemen out there, rate, review, and subscribe to the program. Hoping to get some guests on after game two of the Wildcats. I'll give my predictions. I think I said it at the top, but I'll say it again. I think Perth win this one at home, taking a 2-0 lead in the series. And then they will drop the game in Sydney and then milk out the rest of the home court advantage and be reigned and be crowned champions for what, 10th time? Something like that. Anyway, thanks very much, everyone. Rate, review, subscribe. The other thing just quickly is call me paranoid, but I've been avoiding these supermarkets and shopping malls. I've actually ordered a mobile phone and a SIM card that's going to arrive. It's a whole new number to me. And when I get that number, I will release it. And through the rest of the grand final, and even after the finals, if anyone wants to call me, I will take that call, if I'm available, on that mobile phone. I will record that call, if you're so willing, and that will become sort of a collage of NBL opinion and thought and questions and so on and so forth. That'll be on next time's pod. Fingers crossed that FedEx can make its deliveries on time still. Everyone, thanks very much, and really enjoy game 2 Friday night.